From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
I'll tell you our story, recognizing that we're by no means any worse off than anyone else during this crisis.
It has been a struggle.
So it's been really hard.
You just have to go. You just dig deep and power through, and you're just so tired.
At this point, I really don't know what I'm going to do. It's going to be ugly.
Voices of parents who've been trying to balance working from home or being an essential worker or suffering the fallout of losing their jobs, all while having lost their childcare or school for their kids at the same time. Now, states are starting to reopen. People want to get back to work or find new work, but what's going to happen to their kids? Even before the pandemic, childcare was the essential, expensive ingredient that enabled a huge sector of the workforce to work. So can the economy fully open up again if affordable childcare becomes harder to find than ever? So this hour on Point, childcare in America. And we're going to explore this maybe renewed conundrum today with Lauren Kennedy. She is the founder, co-founder of Neighborhood Villages, a nonprofit group dedicated to childcare sector reform. And she joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. Lauren, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Thrilled to be here.
Well, I want to actually, before we dive into the conversation with you, we've received a lot of voicemails from listeners about this topic, as you might be able to imagine. So let's listen to another message that we got. Colleen called us from Arlington, Virginia. Her husband is an essential worker, and she's still trying to keep up with her full-time job while also taking care of their two young children.
Just so difficult to have a 3.5-year-old and a baby, a 6-month-old baby, and having to just try to teach and entertain and be, you know, they're everything all the time. I think for the partners of essential workers, you know, we have to just hold it down, and that's our role in all of this. You know, people just don't realize the pressure that we are under. You don't even have time to sit and, you know, wonder or worry, or you just have to go. You just dig deep and power through, and you're just so tired.
That's Colleen from Arlington, Virginia. Now, Lauren, I actually think it might be helpful in order to understand sort of what the situation is now for millions of families by starting pre-COVID, if we could a little bit. How would you describe what the landscape of childcare in America has been like?
The landscape of childcare in America in the best of times has been incredibly expensive, hard to find, and a sort of fundamentally broken market that created a very unstable business model for providers. So it was fractured, it was fragile, and as COVID has shown us, really on the brink of instability for a long time, and at sort of no fault of any stakeholder in that market, but because it has been so broken for so long, largely because it's been dismissed, undervalued, and therefore underinvested in by public dollars, government, et cetera. So I'm happy to sort of go into detail on any one of those points. But really, we were looking at a system that, because it was over-reliant on private dollars, and what I mean by that are family dollars paying for tuition. We had astronomically expensive childcare tuition costs. So here in Massachusetts, on average, the fee for putting your infant in childcare was close to $20,000. More than that if you lived in an urban area like Boston. And even if you could afford it, could you find it? We have, I think the statistic put out by the Center for American Progress is that 51% of families in the United States live in a childcare desert where there are no or very few licensed childcare slots. And that's largely attributed to the fact that this is a very unstable business model. 80% of the childcare industry sector is reliant on private dollars. And so even mm-hmm. with tuition costs of $20,000 per infant, that's an insufficient amount of revenue to cover a childcare provider's fixed operating costs to cover the salaries of their educators, leading really to depressed wages for childcare educators. We're only able to pay our educators minimum wage, a little more than minimum right. wage. Many educators don't have access to benefits.
Well, so let me just jump in here for a second, Lauren, if I may, because you talked about the lack of licensed childcare facilities in many communities, but there are home daycares, very loving home daycares in some of those places. Are we including them in this picture?
Yes. So in-home family child care providers, often referred to as family child care providers, are licensed by states. So in okay. sort of that statement around licensed child care slots, licensed child care providers, I mean both center-based care and family child care centers. However, because it has been traditionally so expensive for families, we do see child care providers operating without licenses, but that's suboptimal because, you know, we would like to see all providers licensed, abiding by standard protocols for health and safety, education, equity, et cetera.
Right. So I'm glad that you clarified that because there's all different forms of or types of child care or daycare in this country. So we're talking about the whole sweep of it here today. And just, you know, for people who don't have to pay these prices right now or aren't burdened with this particular challenge, I think every time they hear the how expensive it is, it's kind of eye-popping, right? I mean, in some right. places, you mentioned Massachusetts, it's this similar number in other places in the country about it costs more to send your child to daycare than it might to send them to college. And why is that? Is it overhead? Is it the fact that in high-quality childcare centers, there's a requirement of a low child to teacher ratio? What's driving those high costs?
It's really because at the end of the day, this is an expensive product. This is covering the labor costs, the salaries of educators, and for health and safety and also for high quality programming, it is a high ratio of adults to children, particularly for infants and younger toddlers. It might be one adult for just three infants. So you do need a significant number of adults operating in your childcare setting. Again, you know, whether that's because you're running a center or even in a in-home family childcare situation. So labor, and then also overhead costs, your rent, your utilities, all these fixed costs that childcare providers are responsible for in order to abide by health and safety regulations and also to invest in offering the highest quality program that they can. So I believe when it's come to childcare, we've been conditioned almost to think of this as a service industry that shouldn't be this expensive. But at the end of the day, it really is. And we should value, actually, the expense associated with childcare. The problem isn't the expense associated with childcare. The problem is that we pass the entirety of that expense off onto families. And we haven't okay. societally invested in offsetting that cost so that we can make it more affordable to families who need childcare.
And to be frank, Lauren, as you know well, this is a forever conversation. This is a conversation, a question that's been asked in America year after year after year after year. We will get to why the nation can't seem to move forward substantially on answering that question. But before that, let's just cut to the chase about the impact that the pandemic might have here, because you just wrote in the New York Times that daycare facilities, many of them, may not survive the pandemic. Why do you say that?
We say that because childcare providers are operating as small businesses dependent on reliable revenue coming in the form of tuition fees from families. So with the onset of COVID and with public health requiring childcare centers to close, many providers saw, you know, whether that was just to sort of use these round figures, 80% of their revenue immediately cut off for families who were paying, you know, fully private pay tuition to potentially 100% of their revenue cut off depending on how many, you know, children were private pay versus how many may be coming in on subsidies. And each state really determined for itself how generous that state was going to be in terms of covering the full cost of the subsidy. So these subsidies being supported by largely the federal child care development block grant that flows to providers to enable them to enroll lower income children. So as with sort of any small business that we're seeing under COVID, if revenue is cut off and you have fixed operating costs, you're very quickly pushed to the brink of collapse, to financial insolvency. So child care centers, you know, were able to last a week, maybe 2 weeks, but many had very thin operating revenues, very little cash on hand, so very quickly were forced to shutter. And the question will become, after some of these, you know, public health restrictions are lifted and we reopen the child care sector, will those businesses be able to reopen?
Well, especially if, will they be able to even reopen partially, because they may not be able to take as many children at the same time as they used to.
Indeed. So I think we can expect that many child care programs will be reopened at reduced capacity to be able to abide by, you know, health and safety protocols, best practice that's coming down from the CDC, and also to be able to promote social distancing, which will be a challenge in and of itself when you're talking about two-year-olds. So if they are required to have reduced capacity for health and safety, then again, you have fixed costs not being covered by revenue.
So Lauren Kennedy, stand by here for just a moment. We do have to take a really quick break. We're talking about the crisis of childcare in America before the pandemic and after, and what we do about it. There's a lot more to come. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about America's system of childcare, already expensive and challenging to access before the pandemic, and now more essential than ever to get economies fully back in swing. I'm joined today by Lauren Kennedy. She's the co-founder of Neighborhood Villages, a nonprofit group that's dedicated to childcare sector reform. And Lauren, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we received a lot of calls, a lot of listener voicemails about this issue. So let's listen to a couple of more. This is Sarah. She left us a voicemail from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She's got a 4-year-old daughter who was diagnosed with epilepsy earlier this year. So Sarah had already used all of her vacation days to look after her daughter. But Sarah has now been called back to work.
Her daycare isn't opening for another 2 weeks. But my job, I was laid off, but now I am required to go back, and I don't have childcare. Typically, I would ask my mother to watch her, but my mom is also back to work, so I am stuck here. It's hard because I'm afraid to talk to my boss about, you know, I can't come into work for 2 weeks. So technically, the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be unpaid until her daycare opens, and then I can go back to work. So it's been really hard. And so far, you know, my job has been okay with it, but you know, it is kind of scary.
That's Sarah in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And here's Elizabeth from Rochester, New York. She wasn't able to start work again after her maternity leave because of the lack of childcare.
I was on maternity leave when schools and daycares and everything in the world closed. All my coworkers started working from home at this time, I worked for the local university, although I was on maternity leave. But I couldn't really go back to work because there were no daycares or schools open. I've been taking care of the baby and homeschooling the kids instead while my husband works from home. And we're lucky that he's able to work from home. And it's challenging trying to support the two older kids with their work and their class meetings on Zoom and the varied things that they have to do while the baby needs me and I'm trying to keep everyone out of my husband's hair.
That's Elizabeth in Rochester, New York. Well, I want to hear now directly from a childcare provider. So joining us now is Sarah O'Brien. She owns a home daycare in Silver Spring, Maryland. The daycare is called Happy Place Family Childcare. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
So first of all, Sarah, let me ask you, what happened to Happy Place Family Childcare when the pandemic set in? How quickly did you have to close?
So we tried to stay open. School closed, and we tried to stay open two more weeks because daycares were really not receiving any information. We really didn't know what we were supposed to do. Nobody was saying anything. After 2 weeks, we all got the email that we were supposed to all close on March 27th. And then we were to apply to have this special license to be able to continue to stay open. But there were going to be limitations in how many children we could bring in and how many we couldn't. And we were only supposed to take children of essential workers.
And did you do that?
I did that. But it made it hard because most of my parents, even though they're not essential workers, that they have to be in their office. They do have to continue working from home, but they couldn't bring their children to the daycare anymore.
Hmm. And is it just you at Happy Place Family Childcare, or do you have other care providers who work with you?
I do. I have an assistant, and I also have my mother. Mm-hmm. My mother can't be down here because she's over 65, so she has to remain upstairs. And I have an employee here, which is even making it harder now because she's the only one also in her household working. And I have to start thinking, how am I going to pay her if this continues?
Mm. Now, when you said she can't be down here, are you in the daycare right now?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes. I am downstairs in my home.
Yeah. It must be a little heartbreaking to be in that space and feeling its emptiness, empty chairs and things.
It's really hard. I mean, these children come to us when they're 3 months old and we raise them. You know, we spend 10 to 11 hours a day with them because while parents work 8 hours or so, you have to add the commute of an hour sometimes in some areas because of traffic. So we spend almost 11 hours a day with these children and all of a sudden for them to be gone, it's heartbreaking because nobody was prepared for this.
This is also your livelihood as well, Sarah.
It is. It's really hard because while I love these children, it's also the source of income for my family. It's also the source of income for my employee. And right now, we don't know how it's going to continue. I have been very lucky in the sense that parents have made donations to daycare. But the donations, some of them have paid actually the full month, but some of them haven't. Some of them have just donated a week, which is making it really hard financially because we have other responsibilities. We have to pay someone. We also have to pay, you know, our own rent. We also have our own food. We also have to cover so many things we need for daycare. I am currently a college student. And if it wasn't because one professor helped me to get a scholarship, I would not have been able to finish my spring semester.
Mm. So do you think you will be able to open up again, though?
It really all depends. Right now, I'm staying positive for the fact that I have two children that are constantly coming to daycare. And I know that some parents have said, you know, we're going to continue to try to make some donation to you. But depending on the capacity of children that I'm going to allow to have once this opens, then I have to rethink what's going to happen to Happy Place Family Daycare. Is it going to stay open or is it going to definitely have to close? Because financially, I just can't handle it.
Oh, okay. So, Sarah, the next several weeks or months undoubtedly will be a challenge. But hopefully we'll all get to a point where we can have groups together in safer numbers. Do you think that if the demand comes back, that you would be able to sort of reopen perhaps in the future down the line, or if you close, might it have to be forever?
If the demand comes back, and if I were to know, you know, the thing is that nobody's telling us anything, as in childcare providers, in our capacity. If we were to know that we were allowed to have this amount of children, then you can say, okay, I can stay open because I know there's parents that are waiting to bring their children back. But right now, we just don't know.
Yeah, we just don't know. That's absolutely true. So, you know, you probably heard a little earlier in the conversation, as I was talking to Lauren, I mentioned the obvious point that this has been an issue for years and years in this country, well before this pandemic of 2020. So as a childcare provider, Sarah, what do you think is missing from this conversation? Why do you think we're having a hard time moving forward in finding solutions here?
Because it all depends. And in all honesty, childcare has been, like Lauren had said, so undermined. The daycare providers, educators have always been thought as like not essential workers. And right now we're realizing they are essential workers. How are we going to help them to continue? I mean, if we don't exist, parents can't go to work. You have parents right now that need to be at work and daycares have to stay closed. So I think one of the biggest things is that the government needs to realize that there needs to be a push of scholarships. There needs to be a push of subsidy for childcare, like that the burden doesn't come to the parents to pay the full daycare. But then at the same time, childcare providers are not underpaid either, because this is a hard job. We work 11 hours a day, and then we have to stay cleaning, and then we have to do trainings, and we have to have a certain amount of people working with us. So a lot of the money also goes in maintaining and sustaining the daycare. So it is not just the drop of the children. We have to have insurance. We have so many rules that we need to keep up with that it costs money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah O'Brien, she owns a home daycare in Silver Spring, Maryland. It's called Happy Place Family Child Care. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Lauren Kennedy, let me turn back to you here. What do you hear in Sarah's firsthand experience there and all the factors that she pointed to that are going to go into determining whether or not she can open up her daycare again?
So I think what's incredibly important to take away from this is how Sarah articulated what she has known, what families have known, but what has not been reflected societally is that she is an educator, that she is educating these children during some of the most important years of learning and brain development that they will have, that our child care and preschool teachers are helping us to raise our children, and that they are essential workers. And that this isn't, you know, I think such a question about government investment, or even using these terms about bail out the childcare sector. This is really an investment in our human infrastructure, a very long overdue investment in our human infrastructure. That's to support the teachers, the educators who are in this field, who in turn are supporting families' ability to go to work, to have employment opportunities, support upward economic mobility, but also an investment in our children, that 80% of the brain is developing during these first 5 years. These classrooms that they're in, these homes that they're being educated in, should be, you know, supported to be highest quality that they can be. And that really requires societal investment. And, you know, she also raised the term essential workers. And our child care providers really are essential workers. Something that I found incredibly disappointing or even appalling is that in story after story, we are thanking and listing our essential workers, our essential, you know, industries, child care is often left off that list. And whether that's mm-hmm. child care providers who right now are open, providing care to the families of essential workers, frontline health providers, running emergency care services, they deserve to be on those lists of essential workers. And they deserve, as we move forward and plan for economic recovery, to be treated as such, to be valued as such, and certainly to be operating within a system that pays them wages commensurate with the jobs that they are working. These are hard jobs. You know, all of us who are home with very small children right now very much appreciate our teachers, perhaps more so than we did, you know, before sort of everything began to shut down due to the pandemic.
So, you know, to your point about an investment in childcare, there have been, as you well know, Lauren, there have been several studies about perhaps not all childcare, but early childhood education, for example, and how high quality early childhood education basically pays for itself, if not adds to the overall economy in subsequent years because of all the reasons that you said about setting children up for success. Later in life as they become teenagers and adults. So that's one thing that's known. I mean, there's data behind it. The other thing about childcare in America is that it should be a totally bipartisan issue. It doesn't matter what your political outlook is. If you have kids, you're going to need some form of childcare at most likely, not everyone, but most likely at some point in time. So it seems to be the perfect issue to me, Lauren. That should be like a kind of a natural home run. And yet it's not. Why?
Well, so I would suggest that it is an issue that, you know, everybody is lauding right now. Everybody is pointing to this as the economic driver, the economic, you know, the economic backbone that will support robust economic recovery. However, what we continue to see is failure to then put our money where our mouths are. So I couldn't agree more. We know this is a bipartisan issue. When you poll, should we have more affordable childcare? However you want to cut the data, the demographics, everybody says yes. So where does this break down? You know, folks other than me will probably have a more nuanced answer, but really I think it does break down when we talk about how do we need to think about the public investment that we begin to make in this sector. And, you know, we often sort of find ourselves stuck in this quagmire of saying, well, if you had the child, it's your personal responsibility to sort out how you're going to raise that child, to sort out how you're going to go to work, but also have, you know, your baby at home. And that's really a myth that it's time to dispel. Because whether or not you have children, whether or not you want to have children, this is a public good that's going to return on the investment that we make societally, whether that's because we're raising up a next generation of children who become adults who are healthier, who have higher earnings, who are less likely to be incarcerated, or frankly, because it's going to return money to the, you know, pocketbook of any American taxpayer. Some really interesting research that has come out, I think just this past summer, by Opportunity Insights and Dr. Nathan Hendren, who's an economist out of Harvard, is that when you do a study of all U.S. social programs, the only ones that return on investment are those that are targeted at very young children, which is directly where birth to five programming sits. So whether you're looking over the long term of how will this return on investment 20 years from now when these children become adults, or frankly, how is it going to return on investment much faster than that? Because it's putting in your, again, money in your pocket much more quickly. because we're seeing increased revenue, higher labor force participation. Mm-hmm. If you take $40,000 out of a household budget for childcare, then that's less money that we can spend in our economy. And if you put that money back into a household budget, now how are we able to put more dollars into other marketplaces, into the economy writ large?
Right.
So I think this is really our moment to move in a different direction. And
Lauren, stand by there for just a second, because I do have to take a really quick break here, and we will talk about what that different direction might be when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about childcare in America and what it'll look like after or as states try to open up again, open their economies again. And can an economy fully open up, fully recover if a major sector of the workforce, parents, mothers and fathers, can't or won't go back to work because they don't have childcare? I'm joined today by Lauren Kennedy. She's the co-founder of Neighborhood Villages, a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to childcare sector reform. And Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, is in the studio with some feedback from listeners that's been percolating on social media. So, Dori, what have listeners been saying?
Yeah, well, Kim just messaged us on Facebook to kind of talk about this. Well, why has this problem been ignored? And she says that it's because the necessity of childcare is downplayed because it's perceived as a woman's issue and women's work is always still now undervalued.
Lauren, what's your response to that?
Oh, completely. It's been undervalued because this is framed as a women's issue. I think certainly folks may have continuing opinions about where women should be during these, you know, early years before children become school age. Should they be at work? Should they be home? I think we as a country still have a lot of cognitive dissonance about that. But the reality is that women are at work. 76% of women with children younger than six are in the workforce. And we expect to see them there now. So this isn't, you know, it is a women's issue. It does have direct correlations with women in the workforce, with gender equity, but it's also a household issue. And the more we can sort of go back to that and say the cost of childcare is sinking household financial security, the more we hope we can sort of break this frame and encourage people to say, this is what it's going to take to support family financial security, to support everybody's ability to go back to work, and also have peace of mind about where their children are in school during those early years. The other, you know, kind of unfortunate element of this is that this is a workforce that is largely, you know, dominated by women of color. And so in addition to being a women's issue, we also have the fact that, and I'm just going to sort of say this, racism is built on top of it. And so this really sits at sort of the crux of gender discrimination and racial discrimination. And it's really time to break through that and say that, again, this is a valued workforce and we're no longer going to be okay with suggesting that this workforce is any less important than the teacher that you see in a kindergarten class and the teacher that you see in a third grade class. and really reframe this in a different way.
Mm. So what would that new framing be? I mean, to a certain degree, Lauren, we already have an alternative framing that we've accepted and celebrated in this country for many, 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 many years, and that is public education, right? K-12 education, which every child has a right to in every state in this country, and it is publicly paid for. There are inequities even within that system, but it's there. So, I mean, should we just be building on top of our K-12 model here?
You know, I think that many would answer yes, and then there are other sort of blueprints out there to look to around what could we do with the childcare sector as we know it now. And one blueprint is military childcare, that we, in fact, in this country, do operate a very high-quality and affordable universal childcare program within the U.S. military. And the sort of key pillars of that are that it is affordable to families, and the tuition you pay is sliding scale based on household income, and it is very high-quality. And the way that you get both is by recognizing that government has to come in and subsidize the difference between the cost of what high quality is, and that includes raising teacher wages, that includes facilities, that includes equipping, you know, classrooms to have materials that best support children's learning. So the cost differential there from what families can afford, that's where we need to see the role of, and again, you know, government, we say government, and that's where it breaks down. This is of societal investment, that society steps in and says, just like public education, this is a public good, so we're going to begin to finance it that way.
Okay, so the military childcare model is a really, really interesting one. But there we're talking about government assistance from the federal level. Is that where you'd like to see it come from? Or for the broader American public, is this something that should be further spearheaded by the states?
I think the reality is that to finance, you know, sort of nationally, a program like this, is that it would have to be spearheaded by largely federal dollars. However, I think there is an important case to be made for piloting and testing something like this at a state level. And what I often liken childcare sector reform to is healthcare reform. How we recognize that we had a very, you know, sort of important public good here, which is access to health insurance and health care, that it was too expensive for many to afford. And in order to sort of ensure a product that protected patients' rights and make it affordable for families, we created the health insurance marketplace where government came in and offset the cost of health insurance for families, you know, at or below a certain income level. I'm not saying that has been executed perfectly, but it was one step towards improving access to something that everyone needed. So we could, say, at a state level, pilot something like that, use it as a test case for potentially expanding something nationally, and a state may be able to finance that based on pre-existing federal dollars that come through the Child Care Development Block Grant, other tax credits that are there to support families with young children. But again, to do anything at the state level would take commitment from that state to apply significant public dollars to that exercise.
Right, and in the healthcare example, much of that is made possible through the expansion of Medicaid. So it's like almost a Medicaid expansion for childcare that you're talking about here. Intriguing idea. I'll give you that, Lauren. But of course, the downside to the healthcare example is this is where it's also the perfect example of how politics can be so vicious and divisive that, you know, the Affordable Care Act almost didn't get passed. So we know that for a fact, too. And I imagine that we would have a similar fight in Washington. And full disclosure, your husband is Congressman Joe Kennedy. So, you know, he probably has some insights as to how challenging it might be to move forward legislation about childcare in Congress. I mean, is there even anything on the horizon an inkling of an idea at the congressional level, Lauren?
Yeah, so Senator Elizabeth Warren, as part of her campaign for the presidency, and then certainly as she moves forward in her career as a legislator, put forward a very comprehensive child care reform bill. And other, you know, members of Congress have put forward their ideas for it, too. Representative Catherine Clark, also from Massachusetts, has laid out ideas for how we might go about improving affordability of childcare while simultaneously improving the quality of what we're offering our children. So there are no shortage of ideas, but I think really compelling government movement on this takes social movement, frankly. Mm-hmm. And in this moment, as all of us feel this sort of common pain point about how childcare is going to impact who gets to go back to work, how we get to go back to work, that we have this understanding at this moment that this is no longer any individual families' issue to solve. This is a collective necessity. So can we come together in a more unified way and apply pressure to government, apply pressure to your state policy leaders, to your federal policy leaders, and say it's no longer acceptable to just talk about childcare. We need to see action. And in addition to action, we need to see significant dollars put behind it.
So let me turn back to On Point producer Dori Scheimer with more feedback from our listeners. Dori, what have you got?
Yeah, I think going off what you just said, Lauren, we still have a lot of listeners who are asking these questions like, okay, well, where's the money going? And I think Sarah addressed this, but if you can help us understand even more clearly, yes, the tuition fees are really high for families, but what are the costs like for daycare centers trying to operate?
Largely salaries. So if we were talking about increasing equity in salaries, that would take you from, say, a salary here in Massachusetts of $25,000 a year based on minimum wage to something more sort of commensurate, right, with maybe what a public school pre-K teacher would make. So that could be a jump from $25,000 to $50,000. That's where your money is going. Also to the operating costs, and this will be particularly acute following the COVID pandemic as we begin to reopen. Childcare providers don't have the cash on hand to be purchasing all of these sanitation materials, the PPE that they are going to require in order to operate healthy and safe environments. So particularly in the immediate, it will go to supporting these fixed operations costs that are going to be required. And over the long term, we would hope to see that money going to salaries and again, going into the ability of childcare providers to invest in the quality of programming so we continue to see increased quality improvement as, you know, in my mind, we build out the better future for the country.
And Ben on Facebook asked us how this issue around childcare is also connected to the issue of wages in this country. He asked, you know, is part of the problem with childcare that many people have to work two, maybe three jobs? So is an effect of low wages, bill ratios? You know, what if parents could afford to stay home with their kids more? How would that impact this equation?
So, to me, the most sort of important takeaway, again, being a parent myself of children who are younger than school age, is that families should have choices and families should have options. So certainly what goes hand in hand with that is increasing wages for the worker in America. We know that they've largely been stagnant for the last 30-something years. And that in order for families to be able to afford to stay home with their children, we need to increase those wages and provide them with the financial security that allows them to make that choice.
And Lauren, last
Lauren,
one.
Let me just jump. I something I want to ask Lauren here, if I can, quickly. I'm going to come back to the fact that Lauren, as you know, I mean, this is the work that you do, but We've been having this conversation in this country over and over and over and over again, and haven't really been able to find a workable solution that uplifts all. Whereas, it's obvious, but I'll say it, other wealthy democracies have done that. I do wonder. You had said earlier that there's the thought that if you have a child, you should bear the cost and responsibility of that child. I do wonder if there is something deeply ingrained in the American psyche, or parts, or at least parts of the American psyche, that's so deep that that is the reason why we can't move forward, even when there's bipartisan support for something like this.
Certainly, but I think what we are recognizing now is that, you know, what may have been the public norms in the 50s are no longer the public norms of today, and certainly takes time to sort of encourage different thinking or different feelings, or sort of changing some of that psyche. But it's critical that we do that. So a few things here is we have sort of tried this before. In the 40s, when we needed women in the workforce because our men, you know, were off at war, under the Langham Act, we set up child care centers to support women's ability to go to work, to support Rosie the Riveter. When the war ended, perhaps because we're, you know, what the public norms of were the times, is that we decided women should be back at home, and so we, you know, dismantled the child care infrastructure that we had set up at that time. So again, you know, when it's convenient for us, we seem to know what we need to do. So I would ask people to challenge that psyche and say, you know, it's a myth that families can afford to have a spouse at home. Some can, and those that want to be home should have that choice. But many two-parent households are forced to have both parents in the workforce just based on cost of living and the fact that our wages have not caught up to it. And it's a myth that, you know, quote-unquote, sort of most women are at home with their child. We know that we have 76% of women with kids under six who are in the workforce. And again, certainly, if your preferred choice was to be home with your child, you should have that option, but reality is that many don't. So I don't, you know, have the answers of how we sort of change psyche, other than to say we are again in this collective moment. Let's use that as our catalytic opportunity to change American infrastructure going forward, and would encourage integration of this childcare plank into the platform of other industries that are also working to build a better America as we come out of the COVID pandemic.
Well, Lauren Kennedy, co-founder of Neighborhood Villages, a nonprofit organization dedicated to childcare sector reform. Lauren, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
And Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, who happened to produce this hour as well. Dori, thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.